comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this planet, welcome to the show. I'm glad you're here. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It's the show where you matter. It has come to my attention that there is a person out there who is floating a story about me out there that it's just not true. This person is saying that several years ago I was in the hospital with severe back problems and that he healed me using a pill given to him by the Palladians. Now, I want to say here and now that all parts of that story are completely false. It's not true. I was never in the hospital with back problems. I never received any type of pill from that person. I never had any dealings with the Palladians. I have been in the hospital a total of 3 times in my life, once when I was 5 years old to have my tonsils out, and then once in Bosnia at a MASH unit to have my appendix taken out, once in 2007 when I had a stroke, and that's it. Never been in the hospital for anything else, never have been incapacitated with severe back problems, and I never was healed by this guy and his pills. Now, this story is being put out there by somebody that I know, but I have no idea why. Now, the only person who's ever worked with me on any type of healing is Jerry Wills, and that had nothing at all to do with back problems. Jerry is not the person that's putting this story out there, and I want to make that very clear. It's not Jerry, but it is someone known to both Jerry and myself, and it's false. It simply has no truth at all. So if you run into that story, you know in advance, it's not true. Are you subscribed yet to the K-Files e-zine? Now, if you're not subscribed to the K-Files, you need to. It's our free weekly newsletter, and it really is free. No strings attached. And all you have to do is go to my website, click on the link that says K-Files, and subscribe. And then you'll begin receiving our weekly newsletter. It is a good newsletter. It's a good publication, and it's free. So there's no reason not to do it. Click on the link and subscribe, and then you won't be in the dark anymore. You'll be in the know. Also, for our people that are members, they're subscribers to the site, and you should be. But, you know, right now we've just opened up the brand new members area. And the reviews I'm getting back from it are people love it. And so to the members, if you haven't tried, if you haven't taken it for a test drive yet, be sure you do. Not all the links are hooked up yet. It's about 80% functional right now. But I decided to go ahead and let you roam around in there and see what you think about it. And I'd love to hear from you and know what you think about it. All right, folks, we'll be back. We're going to talk about werewolves and skinwalkers tonight, right after this. You know, just about every culture on earth has legends and folklore about people who transform themselves into animals. Usually, it has to do with transforming into some type of a predator. The most prevalent among those stories, it seems, at least in Western culture, would be the stories about people transforming themselves into wolves. We call them werewolves. Among the Navajo people of North America, they are generally referred to as skinwalkers. Now, living and walking among us right now, today, are people who say that they are actual werewolves. In fact, I have interviewed two such people on this show. I interviewed one of those people two times on this show. Stories of werewolves go all the way back to the very dawn of history, but is there any truth at all to any of these bizarre and fantastic tales? Are they really fantastic, or are they perhaps real? My guest tonight is paranormal investigator and author Sean Belekaroff. Sean, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hey, great to be back. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good. Sean, you've been very active, very involved in researching all kinds of paranormal phenomena. And there are people that would look at this werewolf topic and they would say, well, now that's not paranormal, that's occult.
Right, right, right.
However, folks, we have to understand that anything for which we don't have a scientific explanation is paranormal. It may also have some other tags attached to it. Some paranormal things happen that are astronomical. But this carries a tag with a lot of folks of being occult. But that's not the case all down through history. Although it has been considered something strange and bizarre, and today we use the term paranormal. Sean, why have you gotten interested, or why have you been interested in looking into this whole werewolf thing?
Oh, well, first thing, they're like the ultimate boogeyman. I mean, what could be scarier than a werewolf? Vampires haven't got anything on a werewolf for me. You know, some people like the vamps, and every man's got his opinion, but oh man, werewolves are spooky. You know, they're the ones that are kind of that on that threshold between civilization and the natural wild order, and it's kind of also represents the darker side of man too. And I think a lot of that we'll kind of get into tonight. Like you were saying, you know, it's not always dealt with in occult terms. There's almost always magical properties attached, but at the best, I think most of the times it's kind of seen on as being like fringe type magic, and some of these people that are very much into the at least studying all wherever mystifying mystical arts are studied, it definitely follows the suit. So it's been something that I've been interested in for a long time, and as you were saying earlier, it does have roots in the earliest history of man, from the first cave paintings that were done in Peru, France, and throughout the world. There's depictions of animal and human hybrids, basically most essentially werewolves. Our Neanderthal and our Cro-Magnon brethren ancestors, I don't think they were very concerned with the day-to-day existence of survival, and then basically they were only concerned with things that would actually, you know, be very pragmatic and practical. So when you look at these cave art, it's something that represents like a library, basically a repository of knowledge that they hand down to subsequent generations. So I think it's very interesting that these representations were very real to the people that documented them. So it's, again, you know, something that's been with us since the first part of our human evolution. So it's something that's had some lasting power for sure.
It is. I find it to be very, very odd that, as you said, most of this, the ancient cave art,
Right.
Has to do with things that are very, I'll use the term very realistic. Pictures of animals that we recognize.
Right. Hunting, fishing, mm-hmm. very utilitarian, right? It's something that's, you know, it's not flights of fancy. You don't have a Harry Potter series on the cave wall, so I think it's interesting that they kind of made a connection to the werewolf or whatever this animal-human hybrid may be as being part of a real culture, as being part of their real everyday lives. I don't think there was much of a distinction. And I know there is some other caves in some places that have the beginning of shamanic type practices and kind of the initiation chambers in this, but the very early ones, there is no such places, and it's just kind of interesting to see that this might have actually constituted a real threat or a real danger that they were dealing with.
All right, now as you have studied this, have you come to any conclusion yourself about whether it's real?
Right. To draw a conclusion on any of this stuff, I think, is a little premature because, you know, we're never going to be satisfied until we have, you know, all the evidence in. And I think when you're dealing with supernatural and the paranormal, it's almost impossible because you're dealing with the unknown. So it's very hard to, you know, definitively say one thing or another. But I'm kind of the opinion that these things are probably some kind of astral slash interdimensional type entities. I think that they can be conjured up through dark magic practices a lot of times, and some of the animistic atavistic type of practices, the you know, animal magic and this type thing. I think they also can kind of step in from another dimension, being one of those creatures kind of like the Mothman entities, and I think that they may have a root in human psychology, and actually our own mentalities may be kind of helping to facilitate some of these sightings. And there's a strong occult aspect that's really been present in the last 20-25 years. And I will touch on that here in a little while with, I think we talked about it a little bit before, with the Hexham Heads and some of these stone statues that were found near, you know, where predominant werewolf sightings. So I think that there's, it's kind of moved into a direction where we can at least put it into the category as it being part of at least an occult magic phenomenon.
You know, one of the most astounding things that ever happened to me on this show was, and I mean it really was pretty astounding, and that is I was interviewing a scientist who does a whole bunch of really top secret stuff, inventions and development and stuff for the U.S. government.
Right.
And I was interviewing this guy, and he put out a call. No, let me correct that. I had interviewed him earlier in the week, and then I was interviewing this werewolf, and the scientist called in.
Uh-huh.
And he put out a call to, issued an invitation to this person who said he's a werewolf, and put out a call to all werewolves,
right,
and said that the U.S. government has need of them.
Yeah.
And would like to talk with them. Now, that was pretty astounding.
That is very interesting. You know, that's definitely one that I would have me pick up my job off on the ground with that one.
Well, there was one that topped it. I got an email back from him a few days, maybe a couple of weeks later, telling me that this guy that I'm referring to that said he's a werewolf,
right?
He said, that one's the real thing.
Yeah. That would be interesting for sure. And you know, the military, both on all, you know, all the major superpowers in China, and especially with Russia, have definitely delved into the whole parapsychology field and trying to establish. I know that I've heard reports about vampires being recruited in certain parts of Russia, and I know that there's been some files that have been, you know, leaked, and the legitimacy is, you know, kind of in question. But there's some interesting stuff out there for sure. May have a little werewolf army going, a little werewolf SWAT team. That would be something, huh? But there was in the Nazis regime, there was a group that they called the werewolves that were these really fierce guerrilla fighters, and you know, Hitler was big into the occult and that type stuff. So that was another little interesting fact I stumbled across in some of the research, just being a point of interest.
Were these people who thought they are werewolves?
No, I think they just took the name for the ferocity of, you know, of the image and this type of thing, and because, you know, Hitler did, you know, with a lot of black magic stuff, so I think that probably it was more of a nod to that than anything else.
All right. Is there some place on Earth that is kind of the hot spot for werewolves?
Yeah, anywhere that's in the more remote reaches of civilization, this is where you see your biggest encounters with werewolves. It really, there isn't one specific region that's more active than another right now, as far as that goes, because we've been getting a lot of reports here in the U.S., even down here in the Ozarks lately. I've had 3 reports in the last 6 months, so that's extremely high for, you know, for me anyways, to get that many reports. So it might be an interesting summer, but I think, again, you know, it just tends to be right at the edges of civilization. It's kind of almost represents that threshold. We was talking about it earlier, just, you know, with the creature itself, but it's also, you know, always at the edges. So, of course, you got your Wisconsin Beast of Bray Road that was hot through the 90s, and, you know, so you still get reports of that, and we get that through Linda Godfrey and her little witticisms. I love her. She's an excellent little writer. And then you got the Michigan Dog Man, of course, that's supposedly comes back either every 7 or 17 years, which is, depending on your source. You had some reports of some activity down here in the Ozarks that stretches back about 100 years. You've got the Loup Garou down in the Louisiana area, you know, the French werewolf, so that's kind of interesting. And then there's some reports, of course, of on the West Coast, more in the Pacific Northwest. So it's you know, that's just the U.S., but it tends to run in cycles. The werewolves do seem to have some connection to both times in which we're in high seismic events, whenever you have a lot of activity with tectonic plates and such, because what basically happens is you have these emissions of just clouds of electromagnetic energy. And if we, you know, go with the theory that supernatural manifestations have some basis of, you know, using electromagnetic energy, that would be, you know, a prime time for them to kind of appear. And they do kind of appear along the fault lines quite often. So that's a possibility. And then you have the fact also that they appear quite often when you have major conflicts, war events and these type things. And with all that's going on right now, we've got some war stuff, but it's also got some man-made oil spillage and plenty of other catastrophe on our plate right now. So it's been hopping lately.
One of the interesting arguments that has been put forth as a reason not to believe that there's any such thing as werewolves, and I'm not saying that I do believe it. In fact, I my position is I don't believe anything, and I don't disbelieve. I just listen and research and investigate and think. But one of the interesting points that's been put forth, you touched on it, and that is the connection with seismic events and the release of electromagnetic frequencies and so forth.
Right.
And what the theory says, well, it's well known that electromagnetic frequency can make a person hallucinate.
Absolutely.
However,
auditory hallucinations.
Well, the comeback, I guess you could say, to that theory is when you have 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 people, a group, who all see the creature. Could they all be having the same hallucination?
Not to shoot myself in the foot with my argument for werewolves, but yeah, theoretically they could, because if you're dealing with something that's really deep rooted into your mind, like an archetype, you could have. It may not be an exact description, you know, if you look at the witness testimony, but it would still be the same general creature. That's not always the case, but I mean, if you are dealing with something that would be like an archetype, it would be kind of so fixed in our consciousness that it would at least kind of retain some of the same properties. But you know, at the same time, I don't even think that negates its existence, because I'm kind of the mind of and I think we talked about it pretty extensively last time, but us being in control of our own, creating our own realities, and I think when you look at some of the thought projection and some of these things that we touched on last time, I think that that is a possibility. You know, it could be a real physical creature for that moment, because you've got cases where you have werewolves leaving behind either hairs that are unidentified canid type hairs, or you have footprints, or you have this or that that's been mauled, supposedly. Now, that could be bare things, but there's some interesting evidence that's left behind in some of these places that don't mesh with the physical theory. It seems that they're here at least for a moment in time, and I think that's kind of the thinning of the veil of reality, and I think that that's when they kind of step through, and some of these creatures from our deep recesses of our mind can kind of manifest much easier. So that's kind of my position, which is kind of an abstract and out there position to have anyways, but I will play the devil's advocate for the science world on that one.
Well, you know, I have a different theory about reality. I think it's real.
Right.
And I think that nobody creates reality. It happens, and we create our perception of it, and we create our response to it, which in turn then creates the consequences that flow to us.
Right.
But I usually say, if we create our own reality, then what about someone who really, genuinely, absolutely believes they can fly? If they step off of a skyscraper, will they fly or fall?
I don't know. I've heard some shaman in Africa that could do it, in Australia, and you know that you have the some of the religious miracles and what have you. So, you know, there's always a possibility. But yeah, I absolutely can understand what you're saying. I think reality is a very complicated thing. It's you know kind of a construct that's made up of both our collective and our individual perceptions and our own, you know, a little bit of aspect there. So that's kind of why it's the religions always play off the idea of, you know, everybody has to believe in my theory of reality, because the more people that believe in that reality, the more likely it manifests just de facto, I think. But that's, you know, that's just my interpretation, and you know, I haven't got even a high school education, so you know, it's all up in the air, I think, for people to kind of just dig on and think about, because it's really we've seen a lot of changes in the way science views a lot of this stuff.
Hey, we have to step away for a break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More werewolves and skinwalkers right after this. Welcome back. We're talking with Sean Belekhirov, and he is a paranormal investigator. He is a published author, and he's been with us on the show before. We're talking about the whole idea of werewolves, skinwalkers, etc. Sean, let me ask you about this.
Okay.
What about modern-day werewolves? People right now who believe themselves to be werewolves, is there any evidence that you've come across that this may be true?
I haven't found anything with specific individuals that have been tested, but it tends to be kind of frowned upon in the scientific community, testing for such things. So I haven't seen it, but, you know, your story from earlier was definitely a very interesting tale there. There has been some cases more in the field, and especially abroad, where you have, you know, kind of the whole scenario that plays out in a lot of the early werewolf stories, where you have somebody that'll be an outsider, say a hunter from another place. In one case, we have a gentleman by the name of Harold Young, and he was a very well-known naturalist, and he was eventually made the Thailand zoo operator. He was the primary for the state zoo there. But he kind of had an experience that kind of shook him down and kind of threw him off with his belief system, because he had for years been hunting off of Burma, where Burma and Thailand kind of meet up as and he was kind of the expert for the British Empire down there, and he was stationed with the remote tribal people that were the Shan of Lahu, and he had a lot of peculiar experiences, but the strangest was where he encountered a jungle werewolf that they called the Ta. And this was in 1960 while he was in a hunting party. He had ventured into the deep into the mountains, and he was night hunting, and he figured he could get into the area because he had known these people for decades and decades. He asked for permission to hunt, and the chief said, "No, you can't hunt tonight because the Ta is near." You know, this kind of threw him off, but he kind of was trying to argue, and then all of a sudden they hear a scream. They go out, you know, the young and a couple of the other hunters that are from the native folk there leave the tent, and they you know, trying to figure out where this is coming from. And he hears these warriors that have hunted tigers. He's watched them and hunted with them, hunting tigers at nighttime, and them not show any fear. They're just almost terrified, and they keep saying, "Ta, ta, ta." They figure out, you know, that the screaming is coming from this hut that's adjacent across the village there. They run over, and Young peers in and sees this werewolf, classical werewolf, basically mauling this girl. He pulls his gun and fires off a couple rounds, and he thought he hit the creature. It kind of spun and took off into the night, and they had to wait a couple hours, and it got daylight, and they followed the blood trail and doubled back to the other side of the village, and they went to a hut there. And of course, there's a guy laying there that's been shot underneath his heart, and he's just bled out, basically, and the chief, you know, just is sitting there, and Young's kind of freaking out. "This isn't who I shot last night. What I shot wasn't a man." And the chief just spits on it and says, "Ta," real contemptuously. So there's been some interactions with even some doctors that have documented supposedly jackal shape-shifting in Africa and some of these other places, where you have people in the field that have supposedly seen these things and are of incredibly and impeccable credentials, and you know, we can take their word for it or not, but that's probably, I think, the best evidence I've seen as far as for actual some kind of shape-shifting tradition being physically possible, or at least, you know, through the perceptual basis.
Now, werewolves are supposed to have some kind of special magical or supernatural powers, are they not?
Yeah, generally it's their attributes are super strength, hearing, you know, just kind of heightened animal senses, basically, that you would you know, generally attribute to your boogeyman there. So that's something that's pretty much present in a lot of the older stories, especially. You see, the magic comes from like the wearing of a pelt, or either a bear pelt or a wolf pelt, or whatever kind of animal they're trying to transform into. A lot of the magic is attached to that as well. So,
well, how does a werewolf happen?
How does a person become a werewolf when they're not a werewolf?
Mm-hmm. Is this something they're born with, or?
Well, generally, you know, it's passed along bloodlines is one theory for the physical side of the physical transformation. But also, there's a very strong tradition in a lot of the origin stories of basically it being a human that's consumed human flesh at some point. You see that even though the Wendigo is not a werewolf, that's a tale that's associated with that. Being a skinwalker, you're supposed to either kill and cannibalize a brother or sister or a mother or father, some blood relative, to make a pact to become a skinwalker. So where we get the Lycan word from, King Lycan was the Greek king that had, in some stories, sacrificed his son to give to the gods, to give to Zeus and the gods, and Zeus became so enraged that he turned Lycan into a werewolf, into a wolf for 7 years, and if he could not consume human flesh during the 7 years, he got to turn back. But so there's a strong connection to the cannibalism aspect, especially with the changing into werewolves.
Have you looked very much into what the modern werewolf communities and folks? If you don't know this, there are vampire communities and there are werewolf communities all over this planet.
Right.
And you know, there are people that you work with that you have no idea may be part of a werewolf or vampire community. Now, have you taken a look at what any of the modern werewolf communities say about cannibalism? Are they...
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, the modernized vampire and werewolf folk definitely don't advocate any of that type, you know, just like the vampires kind of very much tend to shy away from any actual blood drinking, more of your psychic vampirism type thing. Now, what I'm talking about is more of a, like I said, you know, I think it's something that's kind of in the archetypal realm more than the physical, you know, world. And that's not to negate. I just haven't met a werewolf personally yet, but I've talked to several people that, you know, have expressed, you know, and there's a whole, you know, history from the whole, the lycanthropy is actually supposedly a psychological disease that makes you think you're a werewolf. And then, of course, you've got your hypertrichosis, where you grow hair. You have the JoJo, the dog face boy, was the most famous with hypertrichosis. But there's whole families, like in Mexico especially, where you have people that are just covered with a dark, thick, almost like fur-like hair. So mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of aspects that are, you know, that could be perceived in a physical way. Just like you have porphyria for the vampires, you have people that are extremely sensitive to light, can literally burn their skin. Their blood cells are so low that they have this very light skin tone, very, you know, fair skin tone. They actually can and do ingest the platelets from blood in the treatment, actually, because they do have to get their blood count up. So there's a lot of similarities in some of these diseases, and I'm sure that played effect with a lot of the werewolf and witch and vampire trials back in the Middle Ages.
What would be the attraction? You know, in preparation for the show, even though I've had two different people on the show who said they are werewolves, and one of them apparently is.
Yeah.
Right. I still, in preparation for this show tonight, I went online and I looked at a number of websites that are there to serve the werewolf community.
Right.
One of them, but nearly all of them, have something on there about how to become a werewolf. But one of them talked about it as though, hey, you know, this is really a cool thing. Interesting, though, most of them said, look, it's dangerous. You don't, you know, don't enter into this lightly, that sort of thing. Okay, but the two that I talked to on this show said it's something that you're born with. You don't become one just because you decide to become one. It's something you're born with. And yet there are those sites out there with instructions on how to become one.
Right.
So what's the mythology? What does it say about how you become one?
There's, you know, it does, it has both of those. You know, with the bloodlines like we were talking about earlier, there's the story of the Leaping Wall. It's at a place in where Lithonia and Latvia and all these connect up, basically, and there's an old castle there. And it's been there for centuries and centuries. And for about at least 5 decades, at least 50 recorded years, there was this festival there. And every year, the people of the, you know, the Slavic people would gather, and it was almost like a carnival-type atmosphere. And at the very height of the festival, at the very end of the festival, there was the nobles would come out, and they would transform into werewolves, and they would have jumping contests to jump over the wall. So with that, you would definitely see it being part of the bloodline of people there. And that's consistent with a lot of Aboriginal, you know, tradition and you know, with a lot of Native American tradition, too. But at the same time, you definitely have a tradition of this being a magical process where you know, like I said, you use either a pelt that is obtained from a animal that you basically trade your soul for, or you have an ointment that's made up of wolf's mane and some of these other you know, exotic and type materials. There's several different ways. There's, you know, the consumption of flesh, you know, especially if it's a close family member, these type of things. So there's definitely elements of both that can ring true, because we've seen both of those stories play out, you know, throughout pretty much the whole history of the werewolfery.
Now, when you were looking at all of this ancient stuff about the different legends, the different myths and so forth about werewolves, did you come across any that had something positive to say about werewolves, or were they always viewed as something to be feared and evil?
Well, you know, that's a good question. The church, being the Christian church, has had kind of a very much that similar question when they first encountered these things. And St. Christopher in the Bible, he's the patron saint of travelers, is known as the dog-headed saint. He was known to consume human flesh on occasion. He was known to talk in this barbar-type language, which is actually where we get the word barbarian, is from the supposed language talked by these dog-headed people in northern Africa. Barbar, that's how they talk, so barbarians. Anyways, and there was a big kind of split in the church. They didn't know how to view the dog-headed werewolf-type folk. You know, on one hand, they said, well, these are creatures made by God, and therefore, you know, they're, you know, while being a lesser, like a slave or something in those times, they're still a creature of God. We should try to convert them and show them the light.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we're going to pick up right there with St. Christopher when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back. We're talking with Sean Belekarov. And Sean, when we went away, you were telling us about St. Christopher. And I got to ask a question before we move forward here. Did I hear you right that St. Christopher was a cannibal?
He had on occasion to consume human flesh. It was one of the things he was always trying to actually keep in check. It was one of his vices, I suppose. So, yeah, no, there's been actually several dog-headed saints throughout religion, St. Christopher being the most predominant one in Christianity. But
now, when you say dog-headed saint, what are we talking about? When you say dog-headed, did he look like a dog?
He had the head of a dog. he talked in short yips and yelps. He does a bar, bar, bar type thing we was talking about earlier. Yeah, absolutely. That's what the literature said. It's been kind of glossed over time, but that's absolutely, you know, the first impressions, and it's clear that they're talking about a dog-headed person, not a, you know, somebody that's immensely ugly or a JoJo the dog face boy with hypertrichosis like we was talking about earlier. So, you know, it's definitely an interesting aspect. Now, like we were saying, there was kind of a split in the church as to how to deal with these dog-headed folks. On the one side, you know, some people viewed them as being, you know, a creature of God, and therefore, again, you know, having a lesser status like a slave, but being a creature of God, need to show the path of light and all this. On the other side, you had the people that believed they were absolutely the minions of Satan and thereby evil. So eventually that position did win out, and the wolf folk were demonized, and it was kind of tough on the church, though, because they couldn't deny the existence, because so many people that had interactions or had known somebody that had interactions with these werewolf type creatures, so to pacify the masses, they kind of had to create this whole thing that was actually a little more convoluted than the actual idea of dog-headed people, which was basically that the devil put it into the minds of people that they were werewolves, fed them the experiences, kind of brainwashed them, and then sent out an astral-type double, basically a non-corporeal entity, to attack and cause havoc and rain havoc on people And that was kind of the explanation from the church for werewolves. But,
all right. Now, you said that these dog-headed people lived in North Africa?
That was, yeah, that was where they were most often referenced. Marco Polo talks about encountering the dog-headed people near Burma, which was where the story we was talking about earlier with the Harold Young, the Burma official, was talking about. So that was interesting. And you have Alexander the Great also referenced dog-headed people in his travels.
You know, what's interesting is that the ancient Egyptian art contains pictures of someone, you know, it's a human with a dog's head.
Yeah, absolutely. The, especially with the jackal. The jackals are very predominant and part of the Egyptian lore. Yeah, Set and Anubis were both the ones, the dog-headed guys that were in charge of the boat of the dead, basically, the River Styx job, basically. So they were the ones that were kind of seen as being the guardians and the passer, you know, the people that gave you passage to the underworld to the next life and what have you. So, yeah, they definitely have a strong tradition of, especially jackal shape-shifting in Egypt and some of the Persian countries. There's a, also Persia itself, which is, of course, different parts of Iran and other countries, has a strong tradition of werewolves called the Soma werewolves, you know. So you can get the idea with the Soma. It's a, you know, a ritualistic-type drug thing, and that's kind of been shown to probably be a just a psychological, you know, kind of trip, and them just running around and kind of acting in the wild. Which there's also been some of those that have been proven, like with one of the leopard cults in Africa. So in places you do have people that still dress as animals and attack and kind of go into this frenzy. And that's, you know, again, when you asked the question earlier about are there any good, you know, werewolves? You know, it just kind of depends on the applications. There was a famous Viking chieftain by the name of Bodvar that was known throughout the land for being able to transform into a bear, and he would just be the transform into this bear, supposedly as an astral double, whatever, and would just tear up the competitors, you know, the enemy, and just slaughter them mercilessly. And it's recorded on both sides of the conflict in the records. So that's kind of an interesting one.
Let's don't go too far from the dog heads.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, this. I've heard of the dog-headed people, but I have never, ever, ever heard that Saint Christopher was one. How did a guy that eats people become a saint?
Oh, because he was using God's will and God's grace to overcome his vices and his lesser self. He was becoming an enlightened being and transcending what would normally be his vicious, you know, nature. Because if you're not with God, then you're vicious and you're evil. So he overcame that, and therefore he, you know, was elevated to this position.
Okay.
Yeah, they talk about it in Werewolves by Ashley and The Werewolf and Lore, I think, is by Bob Curry. There's if you just go back kind of and actually just look into some of the St. Christopher stuff, you'll see the earliest records really talk about him being from this region of the dog people and him being this dog-headed saint, and just how just some of his misadventures in being, you know, a dog-headed Christian. It's actually pretty interesting.
What became of the dog-headed people?
You know, there's still some that say that they live in the mountains of certain areas. They tend to be in the high places, and then you do have the Dogman of Michigan, which again pops up every 7 or 17 years, which would kind of tie back into either cyclical type activity or possibly some kind of astral manifestation. But you know, as far as, you know, regular encounters, no, we don't hear about them as much. But you have a lot of still werefox reports that come out of Japan, Asia, Korea, you know, the whole area down there, and we have werewolf reports that still come out here. So I think that, you know, kind of, there was an interesting article from one of those Ivy League anthropologists, I forget which school it was, but he had explained basically how he thought that Darwin had basically killed the werewolf, in that by people, mainstream society, accepting the theory of evolution, people were having much more of these man-ape sightings that were reported, as opposed to the werewolf dogman type. So it is interesting that you do see a big increase in one and decrease in the other. So it seems to still represent a real event that's happening. It's just how, again, you know, like you were talking about, how we perceive it.
Okay, now you said that you've had three recent reports of werewolves in the area.
In the last six months.
Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I can go into one of them.
Yeah, what happened?
One of them I'm looking to verify still. I've got to trace down the witness. It was an anonymous tip. The other one is verified, but one remains anonymous. But we do have one that was pretty interesting in just kind of the timing of how things lined up. This sighting came June.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're in June. So May 2nd. And the interesting part was the fact that this occurred within about 3 days of when they had capped a cave system that's out just south of Springfield. There's it's been there for, you know, there's been a manhole cover there for probably 40 years. I think it was 67 when it was installed with the manhole. And it was been that way for, you know, decades. And just that week, they had replaced this manhole that had been there, and it has now a little set of stairs that walk down, concrete stairs that go in and underneath the rock. It's got a big steel door and a big iron gate there, and it's surrounded by this chain link fence with the private security thing. Okay. So just, you know, as right around, like I said, within 3 or 4 days of when this occurred, as I, you know, documented from the local paper, making the announcements to the news leader, we get this report of what was seen, and it was before dusk. It was not dark, but it was not, you know, extremely light. But this our witness, McLean, a lady by the name of Dawn McLean, was traveling down this road and going past what's called the River Cut area, which is just south of Springfield. Like I said, about 7 miles south of Springfield. And she's seen this creature that she estimated to be about 7 feet tall cut across this field and go to the edge of this bridge over the James River and hop into this little, like a quarry.
Okay. We're going to leave him hopping into the quarry, and we'll pick up right there when we come back because we have a break that's just about to take over. We'll be back, folks, more with werewolves right after this. Welcome to all of you who are joining us just now in this second hour. We're glad you're here. My most sincere, deepest sympathy for whatever it is that kept you from the first hour, because you have missed several universes of information. But we're glad you're here now. We're talking with Sean Belekarov, and Sean, you were telling us about this werewolf report that you had received last month.
Right.
And the lady observed this werewolf, or this creature, about 7 feet tall, that I believe you said he jumped into a pool?
Basically what happened is he cut across this large field. It was it's probably about a 100-yard field, about the size of a football field. She seen it cut across there, walking, seen it cross the road. It walked up to the guardrail of the James River here, just down south of Springfield. And it stepped over onto the bank and then kind of jumped into this little quarry underneath. When she seen it step over, it didn't bend its knees like a primate, which was kind of interesting. She probably got a look at it for about, she said 45 seconds was the time. It was walking, it wasn't running, it was just kind of moving at a medium pace. Then at the very end, it accelerated to where it was just sprinting, and she thought she had about 45 seconds to look at it. It was right between dusk and the edge of darkness there, so there was a little bit of a visibility issue, but it was very close. It passed within, I think, 30 feet of her car, 10 yards, 30 feet of her car. So it was a pretty interesting She didn't get a clear look at the face, but it was hair covered. It was it seemed to have something of a prolonged face, like something of a snout, and that was what she could make out from the distance where she was at.
Did she say anything about how bulky or heavy this thing appears to be?
It looked to have a heavier top part of the body. Its legs seemed slightly thinner, and they seemed a little bit disproportionate with its upper body.
So what do you think? You think this is a werewolf sighting, or do you think this is a Bigfoot sighting?
It could, you know, it could be anything. That's the fascinating part. And the fact that, you know, we do have, you know, I think almost everywhere in America's got the Bigfoot aspect for sure. Our Bigfoot, our local one here in Missouri, is known to be a little bit more aggressive, and actually in two reports, one that's documented in, Mysterious Missouri, I think this is the name of the book, but it talks about Momo over in Louisiana, Missouri, being actually possibly a dog man. He was much more aggressive and much, he stole a dog. One of the few cases where a Bigfoot actually absconded with somebody's pet happened with the Momo flap, so...
All right, I'm going to open up the telephone lines for our audience so they can join us in the discussion. And the telephone number, let me check the line and make sure it is open. It is working. All right, 623-444-5889 is the main number here in the studio. If you live in the USA or you live in Canada, there is a toll-free number that you can call if you don't have the ability to call without it costing long distance. The toll-free number is 888-223-4599. Now, if you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, I don't have a toll-free number that will work for you, but the main number works. You can call me from anywhere on the planet. And you can also, if you don't want to make the international long-distance call, you can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and scroll down, and you'll see where it says Flash Message, and that's for people outside of the USA and outside of Canada. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
It's Francois from Montreal.
Hello, Francois.
Hello.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Sean.
How you doing?
I'd like to share one of my unbelievable stories.
Oh, please.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to start by the beginning. In year 2000, I was a little bit drunk and a little bit stoned, and I was shopping for a Christmas gift, and I was having some bags in my hand, and in the store, I buy a cowboy hat and some gloves, and I forgot to. I had the glove in my hand with the other bags, and I forgot to pay them. And the guards attacked me on the street, and they called the police. And the police at the police station, they took my DNA by force. And a couple of years after that, I was going to the Hall of Justice to claim the ownership on a boat, and I was misdirected to an office that where the cops goes to make their
sting
job, their paperwork or whatever.
Man, and a cool sting job.
Yeah, go ahead, Francois.
Okay, I walk in the office where they are to go to the secretary. And the secretary told me I'm the wrong place, but during that time there were some cop inside, and there were a female cop that I met a couple of times, and she's a member of a squad that doesn't really exist, that called Patrouille du Cosmos, that means the Cosmos Patrol, that's the French name for the Star Trek series. And she told them, she told one of the big cops, when I walk in, he told me, he told the other cops, what this guy doing here? And the female cop start saying strange things like, I'm a super male, super female, and my DNA makeup is part human, part snake, part wolf, and part gray. And that's it.
Wow.
I look totally normal, except my face is kind of feminine. You know, I'm a big guy, but I have a girly face.
Huh. It did, was it the cop that said you had the super DNA, the wolf DNA?
I didn't understand clearly.
Did the police say that you had the wolf DNA?
Yeah, they were talking in between them, and when I was back in the place I used to live a couple of years ago, the landlord was with they kind of met me in the hallway, and the landlord was with somebody else, and after I was gone a little bit far away, you know, they start talking like the cops are afraid of him. They call him the werewolf, and he put bad people in the garbage.
So were those cops different from the ones that pulled you in the one time? Were they different cops?
No, it's different cops, except that girl, you know. She's I met her a couple of times, like 2-3 times in my life, and she always had the same partner. He's kind of 7 feet tall, and he looks like the valet of the Adam family.
So he's kind of got a little werewolf looking to him himself, huh?
Oh,
yeah,
my.
Or some Frankenstein, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Francois, thanks for the call. Absolutely fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah, no doubt. Sounds like they got a Turner and Hooch thing going on.
All right, the telephone number is 623-444-5889, toll-free 888-223-4599. And I wonder if anybody ever really told us what's in our DNA. I wonder what they would tell us. You know, she said, yeah, he's got some snake and some wolf and something else, and... I wonder, you know, if somebody were to take your DNA or mine, would they ever actually tell us the truth about what's in it?
Well, you know, I'm a conspiratorial type cat at heart, so I you know, always think horribly of those in power. So I'll just negate the answer to that. But I do know that when you look at the human brain, the brain stem, the most inner part of our brain is reptilian. So, I mean, we definitely have different, you know, parts of our body that are constructed from other creatures. You know, we got monkey and snake and, you know, those things. So it's definitely interesting how some of these things are at least possible in the realm of, you know, us having some of the correct proportionate things to actually be able to do some of these things. So it's interesting idea.
There was, I don't remember if it's Twilight Zone or Outer Limits, but there was a show, one of the episodes, where there was this, I thought she was just absolutely a beautiful young lady, but she was in the hospital and they were going to do plastic surgery to fix her so that she would be beautiful like everyone else. Right. Up until the end, you don't get to see what everyone else looks like.
Right, the transformation.
Yeah, and at the end, you get to see what everyone else looks like, and you know, they look like lab experiments.
Yeah, it's beauty by nature's standards. You know, it's kind of like the little story that Serpico told about the king that had went mad because he had drank the water that the witch had poisoned, and you know, only when he drank it and became mad was all order restored, because, you know, he was on the same level as everybody else. So, yeah, I guess I don't want to be beautiful by those standards.
Yeah. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Skye from Alabama.
Hello, Skye.
Hello. I know we're talking about skinwalkers and vampires, but I do want to point out something about the, and then I'll get off of here. He was talking about the saints, and sometimes I think maybe, you know, the dog-faced saint, maybe... I'm Wiccan. Let me start here. I'm Wiccan, and the Catholics in the beginning, like when the Romans decided the pagan people and the Celts wouldn't let go of their goddesses, and right. So they told them that, you know, if you're not going to let go of Saint Brigid, the goddess Brigid, then you'll have to refer to her as Saint Brigid. So actually, Saint Brigid was, you know, the Celtic fire goddess, and Saint Annie right. actually was the Celtic water goddess. So, you know, the dog face, that may be something that maybe the Sumerians couldn't let go of, that the Romans decided, okay, well, then it's going to be Saint so-and-so, and that's how you're going to refer absolutely. To them. And that's how they kind of washed it out over the years.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, because, I mean, you definitely do see that whole juxtaposition of taking one religion and kind of just superimposing it over another. I mean, a perfect example is the Haitian voodoo sect, and you know, in our South here, you know, we had definitely just seen the replacement of the Pantheon of the Haitian practitioners being just replaced with saints, and also with like Magog over in Ireland becoming just King Brian. He just got transferred to a different position. He didn't particularly leave the scene. He just got renamed and moved on. And yeah, there's absolutely that argument can be made.
Sky, thank you so much for the call. Let me ask you something. As a Wiccan, is there a particular Wiccan view about werewolves?
Good question.
Everybody has their own view on it. I tend to think it's something that, you know, it's more energy work.
Right.
I think it's something that they slip into into trance. I'm not saying it can't be physical, but I think it's more of a shape-shifting thing.
Right. So do you think the individual takes on the actual physical attributes, or do you think that they use an astral double type?
I think it's a little bit of both, because I won't say where it is, but I lived in an apartment complex in Texas. That's all I'll say. And there was a couple people there that I honestly thought that they had characteristics of a werewolf. And, you know, and I never did come out and ask, but it kind of creeped me out sometimes.
Was that?
And I'm like, I wondered, do they meditate? Do they shapeshift? Do they? Because it was, I've never met any other people like that. But those people were kind of.
Was it like solely in a physical appearance, or was it also in some of their mannerisms?
Both.
Both. Well, that's interesting.
Well, I mean, you know, you see somebody on TV and you're like, oh, they look like Big Bird, or that person sort of looks like a, you know, they have long jawbones, kind of look like, you know, they kind of had features, but I mean, it was mainly their attitude, their way.
Yeah, see, that's it. Well, when you have a combination of the two, it makes you think, huh?
Uh-huh, sure does. All right, I'll hop off here.
Sky, thank you so much for the call. Very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess asking, is there a particular Wiccan view on anything is kind of like saying, is there a Christian view?
Buddhist view, right.
or a Buddhist view. Yeah, you know.
It's individuals, but still, it was an interesting question.
The movies sort of picture the werewolves and the vampires as being at war with each other.
Right.
What about that?
Oh, it's something that's definitely come up in the last years with your Underworld series, with your Twilight series, with even True Blood on HBO. And if you go back to some of the earlier things, it's really not present. What you actually see is that werewolves and vampires are quite actually intertwined in the folklore. In some cases, if you die as a vampire, you become a werewolf. And vice versa in a couple cultures. So it's something that's kind of been constructed, I think, from Hollywood more than anything, or maybe from the Van Helsing series or something along those lines. But it's something that's kind of interesting to look at as just a sociological, you know, perspective.
Are there any societies today that where the belief that werewolves and vampires exist, okay, are there any cultures where that belief still exists and is strongly adhered to?
Oh yeah, absolutely, especially in your more remote regions of the world. I mean, in southern France, they still have a lot of werewolf reports. In Romania, which was Transylvania, which means beyond the woods or past the woods, so like deep dark woods, they still have vampire and werewolf customs. And there's definitely a lot of high strangeness and kind of stuff that goes on there that just doesn't even get reported because it's so regionally based. So, yeah, remind me sometime before we get over that I'll have to tell you about the 1975 Texas flap where you had police and soldiers all seeing these a werewolf over, I think it was about a two-week period.
Well, let's do that right now.
Okay, I didn't know if we had time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it was a pretty prolific outbreak. It was in Lawton, Texas. It was in 1975. It kind of began when a 35-year-old, pretty young guy, 35-year-old Donald Childs, suffered a heart attack. He was looking out in his front yard, and he seen this man-wolf-looking creature on his hands and knees trying to drink out of an empty fish pond. When he was discharged, Childs told Officer Clancy Williams of the Lawton Police Department, PD, that the beast was, quote, tall, with a lot of hair all over his face and dressed in an indescribable manner. Other witnesses later on, they described the creature as wearing, like, these short pants. I guess it was like a hand-me-down from, you know, his werewolf big brother or whatever, but it was just too small for him. Another officer, Harry Azell, seen the creature, quote, running down the street, dodging cars, hiding behind bushes, then getting up and running again. 20 minutes later, they got a call from a man who claimed the monster was, quote, sitting on a rail outside his apartment, end quote. This was about 11:15 p.m., and the man initially thought that it was just a prank by one of his, you know, drunk friends or something. Until the creature turned its head, it looked at him, and it jumped down the 17 feet. He was on the second floor. It was 17 feet to the ground, and it just took off. Next, the werewolf was sighted by four soldiers stationed at Fort Sill, that freely admitted, admitted that the thing frightened them. It was sighted again on Friday and Saturday night. Sunday night went all right. There was no reports then. Police Major Clarence Hill was the fellow's name. He sent out an alert ordering his men to be, quote, on a careful watch for the Wolfman. I think that kind of illustrates how seriously it was being taken. So, that was basically the end of that flap. It was, like I said, it was about a five to 7 day period. I have to look up the thing in the book. We talk about it a little bit in the book, but it was definitely one of the more prolific, where you have, you know, the names of police officers that are on the record, the names of, you know, people that had seen this and had reported this, and it was just a really interesting flap.
Well, obviously, it couldn't be electromagnetic frequency causing individual hallucinations to all be the
right.
same in various regions.
Right. Especially with the pants. That's a nice little addition that, you know, kept popping up.
So whatever became of this?
Nothing. You know, it was one of those things that kind of got lost into obscurity of you know, some of the more dusty shelves of the paranormal. It's, a lot of times you'll see these, especially, you know, when we're talking about these really super ultra enigmatic type creatures, you know, with your Mothmans or werewolves, they'll pop up and they'll just disappear, and it was as if they were never there, you know, beyond the experiences that the people have encountered. So it's just fascinating to kind of go through all these books and read and just see some of the experiences that people have had.
All right, now early in the show you said that you thought that possibly, and I'll underscore the word possibly because that's the way you put it.
Yeah.
Possibly these are creatures from, we would say, another dimension.
Right.
Okay. Is it a different time, or is it just a different dimension, different universe?
Yeah. I think, to be clear, I think it's part of basically a subconscious construct within ourselves, because I kind of subscribe to the theory that, you know, all universes are within us and all that good stuff, you know, and that's a whole metaphysical discussion we could have there. But I think that we have the facility to draw some of these things that are in our subconscious, or some of these other energies that are what would be classified as magic in some capacities. I think more and more we look into high science, we're understanding that we create a lot of this own magic, but that we have that reservoir to draw on, And I think that we kind of facilitate that. So I think it is kind of dependent on a lot of scenarios kind of lining up, all the moon lining up, the stars lining up type thing, you know, in a much more broad sense. So
all right.
That's more detailed, but much more convoluted, I'm sure.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hello, Bob.
From Cali.
Hi, I have two questions, and I love the show, and I love the guests, by the way, but I'm going to play the devil's advocate, but, like, not really. Can I ask two questions? Okay, the first one is, how is a shapeshifter not far superior to a wolf or, you know, anyone that can, you know, do that which we're talking about because of the fact that a shapeshifter can turn into anything it wants?
Right.
And the second question would be, how come somebody that changes into a wolf only can only use the moon and everything else, and the shapeshifter can do whatever he wants and doesn't require that? And actually, the third question would be, what proof do you have that it's above our dimension? Thank you very much.
Okay. Since the questions are kind of interrelated, I can definitely hit that up real quick. A lot of the traditions and the way we see it portrayed in the media now is that, you know, you just have the shapeshifters being kind of werewolf. If they're a werewolf, that's basically all they can shift into. But if you look at a lot of the native folk magic, the aboriginal magic, they definitely could shapeshift into different animals. I think the werewolf has just kind of resonated with people because, and there are traditions where it's only a werewolf that people can turn into, like in a lot of the Greek traditions and some of these other, and the Europeans, because that was the prevalent predator in that area. But almost everywhere they have this were tradition where they can change into the primary predator is what's known the most, like the jaguar in certain parts of Africa, the leopard colt.
All right, we have to step away for break for a couple of minutes. We'll be back and get your fingers ready to do the dialing. We'll be right back. music used here on The Kevin Smith Show comes from the great independent artists at GarageBand.com. Go to GarageBand.com and check out the fabulous selection they have of great independent music by great independent artists. GarageBand.com. Check it out. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Sean Belekaroff, paranormal investigator and author, and we're talking about werewolves. Now, Bob had from California had asked a question about the how is it that a shapeshifter would not be superior to a werewolf, etc., and you were answering his questions.
Yeah, and I was just saying that even though it's kind of portrayed differently in a lot of the more recent the media with the films and what have you, a lot of traditions do have that shapeshifters can, that a lot of these people that can do turn into werewolves, and some of these others definitely can turn into multiple creatures, birds usually, sometimes insects, other rapid animals like rabbits and deer and type stuff. So there's definitely a much broader tradition than just the werewolves. I just kind of limited it to werewolves for the fact that if we started getting into the were-jaguars, the were-crocodiles, the were-foxes of Asia, and all these others, that we'd be here for another 6 hours. So I just...
Well, yeah, and, you know, we have the mythology about the were-everything. That mythology, or we can say folklore, exists all over Asia, I don't know about Africa, but I do know that it exists all over Asia. It exists all over Europe, and you know, one of the most famous names in European mythology is Merlin.
Right.
And Merlin could change into a bird. He could change into a rabbit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's. I mean, that's what the stories say.
Yeah, I always love the things that kind of overlap into things. And one of those stories that kind of Keel brought out, that he was the first one, at least, that I seen that had talked about it, was talking about this great were-type beast that was attacking this area in Germany. I think it was Frankfurt, Germany. And it was this supposedly this, you know, werewolf or this huge wolf or whatever it was supposed to be. It was just kind of called the Beast. And a brave baron actually went out and slayed this thing. He was fatally wounded and wound up bleeding out and died, but the people erected a statue to him, and the statue's still there today, and he is the Baron of Frankenstein. So,
really?
I thought that was a very good pickup by Keel, and he talks about it in his Strange and Mysterious Creatures.
All right, the telephone number, folks, is 623-444-5889. The telephone line is open, and if you're in the USA or Canada, we also have a toll-free number that will work for you. If you need to call us on toll-free, you may do so, 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can go to my website. You can call the main number, and it will work from anywhere in the world, or you can go to my website and click on the flash message option and send me your thoughts, your comment, your question that way. Is there a place in the United States that seems to have more of these reports?
Yeah, there's two main regions where you do get more werewolf accounts than anywhere else. That's the upper Midwest with Michigan Dogman and the Beast of Bray Road in Wisconsin. They both have a long tradition of werewolf sightings and dogman sightings that stretch back in Wisconsin over 100 years and in Michigan at least 70. And then you have the American Southwest, which also has a lot of activity with the werewolves is generally attributed to skinwalker type activity more than anything else. So you do have those, and you have the Lugaroo down in the south, and you know, like I said, we have our little occasional outbreaks here, but I think that, that if you had to pinpoint two areas, it would be the Upper Midwest and the or the Great Lakes area, if you want, and the American Southwest.
Do you know why? Why are they grouped that way?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because they almost the regions would almost seem to be the antithesis of one another.
Mm-hmm.
One is this region with a lot of lakes, a lot of forest, you know, which is more typical what we think of when we think of the werewolf. We think of the deep dark forest and Hansel and Gretel's tales before they got cleaned up and anesthetized. But at the same time, there's definitely a tradition of nomadic desert werewolves a lot through the Persian, like I was talking about the Soma wolves, and there's other traditions that talk about this group of family, this tribe of people, basically, that every 7 years, one of them had to turn into a werewolf for, I think it was a year, and it was some kind of pledge they had, but I mean, it was just known, I think it was the Nuri or the Nuri tribe that was out of the Asian, not the Asians, but the Arabic area. The Middle East, so there's definitely some that are, and I think that probably see the Southwest, like I said, I think most of them are associated most with skinwalkers, so you do have, something that you can kind of pin that on.
What's the difference between skinwalkers and werewolves?
Well, there's not so much difference, actually, as far as the ritual and the procedure and these type of things, but generally, the ones in the Pacific Northwest are kind of, Pacific Northwest, the Great Lakes region, the Wisconsin, Michigan area, are generally perceived as being these creatures that are live out in the woods or whatever. They're not really considered to be to have a human counterpart, whereas in the Southwest, the skinwalkers, they use the bad magic, is basically what some of the peoples have told me, you know, how they phrase it was the bad magic. And they use those powers to, you know, be able to transform and do these things. So it seems to be, you know, two separate takes on the werewolf activity. So I don't know if that's just attributable to perception or if it's something that actually, you know, exists. But it's, you know, it's up for debate for sure.
There is a Navajo chief by the name of Chief Dan.
Uh-huh.
Chief Dan has been on this show.
Uh-huh.
And he said that he has seen skinwalkers, and they are, you know, they definitely do transform themselves into animal shapes.
Yeah, right, absolutely. No, I haven't witnessed any of that stuff myself, but I mean, there's definitely a tradition there. If you look at the Castaneda series with the Nagual and some of these things, they definitely have the same aspects, and a lot of your southwestern Indian, you know, even Mexico Indian folk definitely have a strong tradition of shape-shifting and some of that considered dark magic, you know, type.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going all the way back to the Aztecs and some of that ceremonial stuff, so.
Well, you know, I'm part Native American, and but my ancestors were Cherokee.
Right.
And in preparation for the show, I thought, okay, well, let me just see what do the Cherokee say about it.
Right.
And what I could find was that my ancestors were too busy with their own civil war between Eastern and Western Cherokee, and there's not much written about this kind of stuff.
Right.
So I don't know if there's a tradition of it among the Cherokee, but I do know, because I'm out here in Arizona, that there is such a tradition, and it is strong among the Navajo.
Absolutely. Yeah, they view the skinwalkers in a whole different, I mean, the Utes, the Navajo, it's a really interesting dynamic, the way that they kind of all see, and there's stories, you know, about how the skinwalker came to be, as far as, you know, the actual origin stories. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they are in the Hunt for the Skinwalker by Keller and Knapp, but it you know, kind of goes into some of that, and it's really fascinating stuff. And if you look at again, a lot of the southwestern Indian tribes, they definitely have a strong tradition with some of that shape-shifting magic. And if you look at, like, the Algonquian peoples and some of the eastern tribes, they have some of that stuff, but not as much as the Southwest. It's the richest with the Native American tradition of shape-shifting.
Chief Dan said there are thousands of them.
That's a scary thought right there. From what I understand about skinwalkers, that's a thousand too many. You know.
Mm-hmm. And he's a fascinating individual himself.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
When you talk with him, you get very clearly, you get the impression that for him, this is not mythology. This is an actual fact.
Right, right. Because that's what they live. You know, that's their life, and that absolutely, you know, I totally concur with that thought process. You know, that gets back to the whole argument that I started in the first place, you know, that, you know, what we believe is what is reality. And I think that, you know, that's a part of that. So I think I can definitely understand where he's coming from.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people believe that, number one, the world is like where they're standing.
Right.
And it isn't. The only place that's like where you're standing is where you're standing.
Where you're standing, right, absolutely.
Okay. And they also think, it's just a normal human trait.
Right.
That people think that what they have seen and what they have experienced is what most people have seen and experienced.
Right.
And that also is untrue. I've seen and experienced things that other people here, many other people here in the United States, never will see or experience, right, because they will never go to those places.
Right.
And I want to add to it that it's a normal human trait that we think that the past was very much like the present. And that's not the case. The past was very different from the present. And there were even, we know for sure, there were different species of animals that existed that do not exist any longer.
Right.
And some of those have gone extinct within modern times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and so it is, you know, a lot of what we think is mythology may not be so mythological. It may be based on real fact.
Well, you know, the Kraken was thought to be a sea tail for years and years and years and years and years, and they just, you know, have in the last 30 or 40 years found these, you know, giant squids that have wound up washed up on the Asiatic coastlines and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, absolutely. We thought the coelacanth was extinct for 60 million years, and it turned up off the coast of Madagascar, so... You know, there's all kinds of weirdness and plenty of mysteries to compel the human mind. As long as we don't get into a closed mind, you know, scenario, because, you know, another tendency of the human mind is to kind of seek out information that reinforces our own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to remain open to all that and kind of look at everything through the eyes of the people that do experiences and try to decide if we, you know, are going to take them at their word, at the validity of what they're saying, and try to incorporate it into our own, you know, worldview. But that's just, you know, where I come from.
Well, you know, let me throw this out for you, and I have to do this quickly because we have a break coming up.
Right.
You know, I used to be a cop, right. And it is my opinion that most people do not lie to you.
Yeah.
If most people lied to you, folks, you couldn't hire enough cops to keep order.
Oh my gosh, I can imagine.
Okay, so most people are basically truthful, and therefore, I mean, there are a few liars out there, there are a few thieves out there, but most people are basically truthful, honest people. And so if they say that they saw something, and you've never seen or heard of anything like that, don't assume they're lying. If they saw it, if they experienced it, they are probably telling you the truth. All right, we have to step away for break, and we'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Sean Belekaroff, and he is talking with us about werewolves.
And the telephone lines are open. We're on final approach, so if you're going to call, you have to do so quickly. It is 623-444-5889 worldwide. That will work. In the USA or Canada, you can call toll-free if you need to. It is 888-223-4599. All right, Sean, let's get to this call that's on hold because I don't want us to run out of time. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, it's John from Vancouver Island.
Hello, John.
Hey, John from Vancouver Island.
Hi. I'd just like to bring up one word, and the word is feral. The idea of wildness,
mm-hmm.
not being tamed,
yeah.
not being domesticated,
right.
that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. There's a lot of cases where you have children being raised by feral animals, especially dogs, monkeys, this type thing. And I think there was a case, I think, in India just in the 1990s of a boy who was raised by, I want to say it was jackals, but it may not have been because they're kind of aggressive. But, yeah, absolutely. There's some interesting stories behind the whole feral side of the conversation there that we haven't even touched on, so...
Yeah, well, the reason I mention that word is I've never seen a were or anything or a shapeshift
right.
or anything like that. But I find it plausible in the sense that, most of humanity is domesticated.
Right.
We are not feral beings.
Right.
And so just on a pure logical basis, for the sake of survival... I can easily surmise that there would be a small group of humans that refuse to go down the domesticated route, that
right.
refuse to go down the technological route, and
right.
what they retained would be, mastery over their own DNA, because
right.
our DNA is kind of locked in.
Yeah,
so
it's
I think
in a different
group
capacity.
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
and
right.
so no, that's why I can believe that.
Yeah, there's a tribe called the Gilyaks over in Russia land, in some of the harshest areas of Siberia, and they maintain that there's this group of they call them other humans, but we call them subhumans, but that are very much type of that feral, almost like a different descendant from maybe a line of Neanderthal or something along those lines. That has retained some of the wildness, and so there's definitely some tradition to support that whole line of thought too.
Now, do they, in talking about these other humans, do they assert that they are extant, that they live today?
The last reports that I had read about it was from 1976. That was when the last anthropologist had went through and was in contact with this tribe, as far as I know. That could have been something in the name of the tribe. It's a nomadic tribe in Siberia by the name of Gilyaks, G-I-L-Y-A-K-S. So you could check it out and see if there's been any further subsequent, studies with it. But I know up until the 76 report, they really maintained that there was still these people that were, whatever you want to call them out there, and they were very aggressive and fierce, and the Gilyaks basically feared them, and that was one of the main reasons why they were a nomadic tribe out in those regions, other than, obvious environmental issues.
John, have you ever heard of the Gilyaks before?
No, that's new to me.
Yeah, it's new to me, too. I'm going to check that out.
They talk about it in Monsters Among Us by Brad Steiger.
Okay. Wow. All right.
I try to keep most of the references somewhere in my brain. So,
John, did you have another question or comment?
Well, just one other comment. If they can shapeshift, then it's likely we're not going to see physical evidence, like we won't see bones or anything like that.
Right.
Because they've got more control over their physicality.
Yeah, no,
and the only other comment I would make is that everything that we find normal or desirable or anything like that, they would find repulsive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and almost, and that's why, you know, I haven't really found a werewolf community per se, because even within these tribes that where these people do transform into werewolves, they tend to be like outcast and people that basically live in the wilderness and are really kind of loner types. So I guess I might be in trouble because I'm a hairy Russian and I spend a lot of time to myself. So,
John, thanks so much for the call. Interesting.
Appreciate it, brother.
That's a very interesting perspective that perhaps there is this feral group.
Right.
That has retained control over their DNA. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling, and you'll have to be very quick.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hey, Terry.
I would like to just ask your guest, does most all werewolves have control over when they change, like you hear about the full moon and stuff? And two, is it natural or is it a curse brought onto them?
Yeah, good question, and the answer goes kind of both ways. In the literature, it talks a lot about how shapeshifting on lower levels can't be controlled. It's kind of it does tie in with the cycles of the moons and some of these other aspects. Of course, you know, when we're talking about the magic, it's the actual transformation process somebody undertakes. But it also talks about as a shapeshifter, if you gain levels, higher levels, you can control your shapeshifting. So it kind of goes both ways on that. What was the second question?
You know, I don't remember. I apologize for that.
My bad. Yeah, I kind of got lost.
Well, I apologize. I'm looking at two different computers and two different clocks here to make sure that we get this timed right.
Excuse.
You know, the young man that I told the story about earlier, who had been a guest on this show, said that he, at first, it just happened, and he had no control over it, and that he had to learn how to kind of control it so that he could have some kind of a normal life.
Yeah, that's been my impression from what I've read and the people that I've talked to and this type of thing, so... Yeah, that's kind of, I think it kind of, if you can exert control over it over time, so. We didn't even get to the werewolf occult connections that I talk about in the book, so we'll have to try it again sometime.
Well, yeah, and you know what we might do is get a werewolf to come on with us.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to ask him.
I'm going to tell you something. They absolutely detest publicity. And
you know, they're the loner types. They're the antisocial. They're basically the opposite of vampires. Vampires are these very social creatures that throw balls and have debutantes and such, and the werewolf is the outside loner. So, you know, it's a nice dichotomy.
Well, it took me about a year and a half to find a real vampire. Found a lot of people that were pretenders, but a real vampire to come on. And it took me about a year and a half or 2 years to find a werewolf that would be willing to be on the show.
Right, so pretty close. That's not too big a difference there.
Yeah, but they would exchange email with me.
Yeah.
But as far as being willing to get on the show and talk about it, sort of open it to the public, they really, really don't like to do that.
If any werewolves out there want to get a hold of me, you can do it at spooksfield@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear and talk to anybody that has any information in that capacity, for sure.
All right. Sean, stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring this flight of the Kevin Smith Show in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Werewolves, skinwalkers, weird stuff. But there are a lot of people out there who truly, genuinely believe themselves to be werewolves, and there are a lot of people who truly believe they have seen them. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.